everyone. Thank you for tuning in to the Postmodern Realities Podcast, brought to you by the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. I'm Melanie Cogdill, Managing Editor of the Christian Research Journal. It's August 2024, and you are listening to episode 407, which is a conversation about consciousness and artificial intelligence, aka AI. On this episode, I'm joined by Dr. R. Keith Lofton, who is professor of philosophy and chair of the Department of Politics, Philosophy, and Economics at Dallas Baptist University. Keith has written an online feature article for the Christian Research Journal. His article is called Consciousness, AI, and the Imago Dei, and you can read his article for free at our website, equip.org. That's equip.org. Keith, it's great to have you back on the podcast.
Oh, it's really my pleasure, Melanie. It's been too long.
Well, today, as I mentioned, we are going to talk about various issues that surround AI, which is kind of a hot topic these days. People probably hadn't really been following this whole issue, but now that all of us interact with it daily, I'm thinking particularly if anyone has a smartphone and asks Siri or Google Voice a question that's AI, or actually tries to click on the Ask Us Anything on any website for a company, it's usually an AI bot, not a real person, trying to feed you answers about your various questions about their product or service. So before we get into specifically your article, can you give us just an overview about why this is kind of an issue of the moment and some of the concerns people have, just generally the unease? Even the average layperson may have.
Yeah, that's a great question. It is, as you say, it has become just prevalent everywhere. I know my phone is prompting me to download ChatGPT-4 for, you know, further integration. When I open PDFs to read journal articles or something on my laptop now, my PDF software invites me to test drive a new AI integration feature. And as you say, I do think that people generally are intrigued, but there is a pretty common thread of reservation, perhaps fear is too strong, but concerns there. Yeah, so AI has been around as a field really for a long time. I mean, as we'll get to, Alan Turing, who is early 20th century scholar, is talking about what we now call AI, and that was, you know, back in the 30s. If you ask certain people, AI, artificial intelligence, is a field of, a field of computing technology that I think some people would say develops machines that can actually think just like humans. I think that definition or construal is a little bit ambitious. I think I would even say illusory. As I argue in the article, that's not even categorically possible. But I think a more generally acceptable definition of AI would be something like a field of computing technology that aims to develop machines or maybe programming that can perform tasks that heretofore were performed only by conscious humans. And so that's a little bit more modest. It's also ambitious. Typically, there are lots of distinctions. There's no uniform, you know, verbiage for the field of AI, but generally people will break it into two parts. On the one hand is what's called weak AI, W-E-A-K. Sometimes it's called narrow AI. This is basically machinery or programming that performs really narrow or specified tasks. Think of it as more like a tool you can pull out of your toolbox and use once in a while and then put it back up. Weak AI is what drives things like Alexa in your house or Siri on your phone. And I don't really talk about weak AI in my article at all. Strong AI is really where the action is in terms of, I think, people's concerns. What is strong AI? This is the branch of the field that sort of thinks of artificial intelligence as much, much more than a fancy tool that you can pick up and use at your leisure and put down as you lick. Strong AI will tend to view the machine as really or genuinely or actually a mind, on par, in fact, to listen to some people talk, even surpassing the conscious human mind.
I do want to talk a little bit more about consciousness and AI, just because I think that if you think of pop culture and sci-fi, it seems so real to people. If they've watched right. the movie Her, for example, that was before yeah. I think Siri was even introduced. And so there, some of this, and or, you know, 2001 Space Odyssey, it seems almost prophetic when you think about now, or, you know, some of the different films that we've watched. And also because there are some human elements that have been developed with AI. So if people have noticed in the past, if they've asked, let's say, weak AI like Siri or things like that information, it was a very robotic voice. But now real humans have allowed their voices to be mapped. And so all right. of those have. And so if you ask ChatGPT something, it seems like some human person is talking to you because it is what an actual human voice that they've mapped to right. use and sound very lifelike because it is somebody's actual voice. And the other thing about ChatGPT, so if people just how AI like at the very lay level works, it's like the programmers have to feed it information, but it gets quote unquote smarter the more that it learns. So there are things that are weak. So for example, Siri is a firm, Apple is a very weak AI. The Google AI is only slightly better. It will read to you things from the internet where Siri will just say, oh, I found a link for you. Well, that doesn't help when you're driving, right? But ChatGPT, when it started out, it was quite weak. It has gotten very, very strong, such that I know people in that are computer scientists that are in the field in Silicon Valley, and they're completely amazed by how where ChatGPT is now, and they use it daily. So, and you know, I haven't experimented with ChatGPT since it first started and was rather dumb, but I think it's gotten a lot stronger. So, just the idea of that when you're interacting with that, you talk about in your article that people apply this language of consciousness to computing technology all the time. I don't know if you actually ever saw the Steven Spielberg film AI, that was like not just AI, but also like sci-fi, you know, robots. Right. It was really creepy. And so is it a problem that people talk about computer programs in these kinds of terms? Because, you know, my kids remind me, they both have, one's studying to have a degree in computer science, one has a degree in computer science. And so we start thinking about it. Even when we talk about Siri, it's almost like a person. Why did you ask Siri this thing or whatever it is? So is there an issue that we talk about AI in this way? Because that's where we start to get a little scared. Like, will it become literally conscious and take over from humans?
Yeah, there's a lot there. I think, let me just say a few things here. Yeah, ChatGPT has come a long way. There, public-facing current iteration is 4.0. I mentioned ChatGPT 4.0 in my article because a really interesting UC San Diego study came out earlier this year. We may get to that. But yeah, so it has come a long way, but it's because ChatGPT 4 is built on what's called a large language model. And so as with all AI, the idea is basically input meets programming leads to output. And the large language model is just built on massive, massive amounts of data. I mean, basically anybody on LinkedIn is probably once a week or every other week getting a private message from some company asking you to contribute to what's called training the data set. So in your area of expertise, you will feed in training data, which is intended to and does in fact sharpen the responses generated by GPT-4, hence the expression generative AI. Unfortunately, lots of college students are familiar with ChatGPT-4, not here at DBU, of course, but, you know, other schools, because it can generate pretty impressive looking articles or papers much quicker than I can. Yeah, you're right. People are really concerned. I think there's a lot of potential for good with AI. So I don't want, you know, listeners to think that this is, you know, all ran on the parade of AI. There's a, especially in healthcare, there are absolutely incredible goods being done as we speak using AI to help people, especially people with what has for ages been thought to be basically unhelpable conditions. So it is commonplace for people to use the language of consciousness. We've been doing this with computing technology long before AI sort of went mainstream. Think the parts of our computers, a logic board, there's so much memory, but your computer doesn't actually have memories. But I know from experience that there's a lot of pushback to that. And so I always say something like this: if we uploaded every single picture and video that exists from my and my wife's wedding 20 years ago, and then we had wonderfully detailed write-ups from every person who attended describing what they saw in incredible detail, and we uploaded that to the memory. Well, we upload all these things to my computer's memory, but the computer doesn't therefore remember attending my wedding, right? I mean, that makes it absurd when you really think it through. But as long as people are clear, we're using this language figuratively or analogously, then it's really fine. I know when my truck gets out of alignment and, you know, kind of wants to pull toward the side of this side or the other, I need to go get my front end aligned or my tires rotated. But you hear how I say it, my truck wants to pull to the side. Well, my truck doesn't literally have desires or, you know, some kind of an inner conscious life. We just kind of adopt that language because we're familiar with it from the life of a conscious human mind. And so I think that, you know, it's just a perfectly innocent way to use these terms figuratively. The problem that I think comes, with people just eventually losing sight of the fact that we're using these words figuratively. And I recount at the beginning of my article a conversation I only had, this was maybe 2 months ago, with a computer programmer friend who we weren't even talking about computers or AI. We were talking about undergrad studies. And a computer programmer just threw out there, as if it were just a well-established matter of fact, that AI, quote-unquote, knows things and thinks this or that and is, in fact, conscious. And I challenged him on it, and that's when we get onto the Turing test. But that's when I finally realized, okay, I think enough people who should know better have just kind of lost sight of that we're using these terms figuratively. These terms, i.e. the language, the nomenclature of human consciousness, only figuratively applies to AI. But no, I mean, because it's only figurative, I think it's almost a little comical when people think, oh my goodness, it's going to be, you know, the Terminator movies on Earth soon. It's like, no, it's not. Rest easy. It's not really possible for there to be conscious. It's a category mistake.
And I think our maybe interactions with programmed AI, we put onto that layer of this is like talking to a person when you're not talking to a person. You know, maybe that's just something natural that humans do.
I think that's a good way to put it. It's like talking to a person, but only on the surface. It's only like talking to a human because the AI can generate outputs that superficially resemble outputs, quote unquote, generated by another conscious human when they're speaking. So as you and I are speaking, is it theoretically possible that there isn't a human being on the other end, but you're pranking me and this is like a incredibly sophisticated AI that I'm interacting with? Yeah, sure. And even if I mistakenly believe that the voice I'm listening to in this conversation doesn't belong to a human named Melanie, but is in fact a computer AI voice, well, that doesn't make the machine I'm interacting with conscious. Makes it pretty sophisticated, but it's not conscious. It's just like talking to a human.
I probably don't tell you this enough as far as bookmarking our website, equip.org, as a resource for you to find all kinds of articles about so many different subject matters, not just the one that Keith has done for us on consciousness and AI and Imago Dei, but also just our back catalog of everything from more than 45 years of being a publication of the Christian Research Institute. So all of that is not under a paywall. All of those articles, you can freely access the archive, plus the entire archive of the Postmodern Realities podcast is up there, as well as the archive for our new podcast, Christian Research Journal Reads. So I think all of our stuff is very relevant. I mean, even articles that we do in the cultural apologetics column, you might think, well, it's not the latest movie or TV series, but due to streaming, everything lives on probably forever. I mean, people are now watching old television series and movies from the 90s and the aughts and other times that were decades ago because they've found a new life on streaming services. So all of the stuff is still very relevant. And I hope that you would bookmark equip.org. Now, I also always ask you, because I would really appreciate you just giving us the gift of your time, just partnering with us in that way by leaving us a written review would be the best thing, or a starred review on Apple Podcasts, because that's the main aggregator of podcasts on the internet. What it does is it really is helps get the word out about the podcast. More people can find it. Plus, just you telling a friend or posting your favorite episode on social media. But if you're not on social media, you could certainly email it to a friend, text it to a friend, or just let them know about the podcast. And we're really grateful for that. Also, if you would want to partner with us financially, you can give us a tip for our content. So how you do that is go to equip.org, click on journal, click on Postmodern Realities podcast, and at every single landing page, there is a link where you could give us a tip. Maybe, well, coffee's going up these days. It used to be $3, but if you get a medium these days, it's $5. So $5, $10, something like that. That would really help us out to continue to bring you this great podcast. I hope you're enjoying it, and I hope you're enjoying this conversation. So back to my conversation with Keith Lofton on consciousness, AI, and the Imago Dei. A little bit ago, you mentioned Alan Turing, and some of our listeners might have seen the 2014 film with Benedict Cumberbatch called The Imitation Game, which was about Alan Turing. But if you haven't, who is Alan Turing and what is the Turing test? That's usually what's associated with him. And why does that test get talked about in regards to AI and consciousness?
Yeah, that's a great question. Alan Turing was a really interesting fella. He didn't live long. I think he, if memory serves, he passed away when he was maybe 40, 42 years old. But he accomplished a lot. I'm not exactly sure when he was born, but he went on to study mathematics at Cambridge in the early 30s. He wound up coming over to the U.S. to do his PhD in mathematical logic, in mathematical logic at Princeton. And so scholars will know him from some of his published academic works, but he became known to the public, I think, as stories began coming out after World War II and the state secrets began slowly trickling out. He's probably most widely remembered as portrayed in the Imitation Game film for his work at a place in outside of London called Bletchley Park, where just scores of incredibly hardworking and bright minds were cracking various codes from primarily the Nazis. And of course, he developed what think of as the Turing machine to work on the cracking of the Germans' Enigma machine. And I loved that film, by the way, The Imitation Game. So Alan Turing, I think he's generally regarded as the father of modern computing technology. He sort of did a lot of the work that spearheaded the AI movement now. He never developed anything that he called the Turing test. To my knowledge, he never used that expression. But what he developed was called the imitation game. And that game is now sort of widely known as the quote-unquote Turing test, or now there's a variety of kinds of Turing tests, but they all have this sort of similar thing in common. And I'll just summarize the game. It's not very complicated. The idea is that he imagined two rooms. These rooms did not communicate with one another visually. You couldn't see into them one from the other. And in one room, you'd put a human being that he called the investigator. And in the other room, you would put another human being as well as the machine. And the job of the investigator is to pass messages into the first room. And then the job of the human being in the room with the machine was to help the investigator try to determine whether the investigator was receiving answers from the machine or the other human. So, for example, he doesn't know which is which. He can't see in the room. The investigator can't. So he'll pass in a question. He just calls them X and Y. And he'll say something like, does X play chess? And after a second, a response will come. Yes, X really enjoys a rousing game of chess. Well, then the other entity in the room will say, wait, the person who just gave you that reply is the machine, not the human. But that could have come from either the machine or the human. So the investigator has to ask increasingly clever questions to determine which of the two responders, X or Y, is the human and which is the machine. And as he predicted, you know, sometime in the future, but now around our time, that eventually the programming would become so sophisticated that after about 5 minutes of interacting with the occupants of the other room, any investigator, you, me, anyone, just wouldn't be able to tell the difference between X and Y. We would have no idea which was human and which was, you know, artificial intelligence. And so passing the Turing test is an expression that we use when the machine or the AI in the other room can perform such that the investigator or the user doesn't know whether it's an actual conscious human or a machine that they're interacting with.
So I'd like you to maybe define for us what is consciousness, because I think that's kind of at the root of some of our discussion. People want to know about what defines that. Because even if you talk to just a lay person or, you know, who doesn't think about these things, or just the average person, they would define consciousness in a specific way, which also causes them to be concerned about AI becoming conscious. Or there might be computer scientist influencers out there who might, I guess, in popular culture suggest that AI could become conscious.
Right. Yeah, that's a great, I should have answered that with my last one, shouldn't I? So consciousness, first of all, it's just incredible. The nature of consciousness is subtle and gets, as you can imagine, pretty complicated and nuanced, but we are all immediately familiar with it. I mean, everyone listening to and thinking about and, you know, living their lives is conscious. And it is unfortunately, I think, in the commonly reduced to being able to compute things. And it's true, we can use our consciousness to quote unquote compute things. We'll come back to that in a moment. But that's far too reductive. It's just, if you're a Christian, it's incredible, even astonishing, that we're created in this unique way. I of course, we'll get to this, but I believe wholeheartedly that consciousness is part of, but I want to emphasize, not all of, the image of God, which we're created. So what is consciousness? I think the best thing for a person to do would be not to start with Google, what is consciousness, but just get comfortable and close their eyes and turn their attention inwardly to their own inner life. This is what psychologists call introspection. And just sort of pay attention and sort of take stock of what's going on in your inner life and what is it actually doing? What are its capacities that you're not currently using? So here's some thoughts. I'll follow a pretty common breakdown here. This is a summary. It's not exhaustive, but consciousness is largely a matter of what philosophers call mental states. So think, as you and I are having this discussion, we're having obviously the same discussion, but I can't experience this discussion as you do. I can extrapolate from what it is like for me to experience this discussion to what it probably is like for you, but I don't have the ability to actually experience what it is like to be Melanie. And as a sign of the Lord's mercy, you don't have to experience what it is like to be Keith. It's often a strange experience. But this would be, there's a what it is likeness to being a conscious human. So you have a first person privileged outlook on the world. So I likened one potential of consciousness a moment ago to computing. That was an allowance for the sake of AI discussion. But one mental state is what we would call thinking or understanding. We have other mental states. We can experience things like sensations. So the sensation of being in pain is not possible for a plant, and it is not possible for my truck tire, and it isn't possible for a machine. We can train a machine to mimic the sensation of being in pain, but that's not the same as the sensation. Another mental state is experiencing desires. You know, people have desires to take an alternate route to beat the traffic. That's not the same as Siri knowing which route will allow you to beat the traffic, but the desire to seek and apply knowledge in a certain way, or the desire to just have donuts for breakfast on Saturday. Let me scooch up to understanding, because that's the focus of my article. I want to explain consciousness largely in terms of these mental states, and I want to focus on understanding as the sort of a test case for AI. And so for now, so I don't get too far ahead of you, I'll just say the mental state of understanding, of which consciousness is this one part of consciousness, is when we can form thoughts and think about those thoughts and lead to a mental state that is not possibly physical and not possibly reduced to a simple function of programming.
So you just mentioned the mental state of understanding, and you defined it a little bit for us. So why is the mental state of understanding relevant to this discussion of AI?
Yeah, that's great. That's a great setup. I think that people who genuinely believe that AI is conscious, in my experience here, this is a little anecdotal from conversations, I think that they are unconsciously, I think largely unintentionally, reducing consciousness to understanding or capable of exhibiting understanding. When you ask, you know, ChatGPT 4 some question of which you have no clue what the answer is, and a nanosecond later ChatGPT 4 gives you the answer, you will think, or I hear people say, wow, ChatGPT knows, or wow, that's incredible what ChatGPT 4 understands. I don't hear people talking about ChatGPT 4 or other AI as, wow, ChatGPT 4 really gets me as a human. We have an emotional bond. You know, ChatGPT 4 senses things in a really special way. I just don't hear those aspects of consciousness talked about. And so because I want to meet the thinking where it is in terms of its mistakenness, in my view, I thought focusing on understanding, the mental state of understanding, would help people connect a little better with the what I hope is a corrective to the way we talk about AI.
So one of the people that you mention is American philosopher John Searle, and yeah. I'm surprised he's still alive.
I think he's a mid-90s. Yeah.
Yeah, he's in his 90s and still alive, but maybe about 30 years ago or so, he did some work on consciousness. So can you tell us about his importance and also some of the notable things about his work that we should know about?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's hard to think of, you know, really names that cast an incredibly long shadow in the philosophy of mind. Any short list even would include John Searle. Other names, Jaekwon Kim, Paul Churchland, other names are there. But, you know, John Searle has published so much widely influential work on the nature of the mind, the nature of consciousness, the brain. But what I really like about using Searle is he is no friend of Christianity. He does not, you know, he's not ugly or anything, but he's not a believer. And he is not even a dualist in the sense that I am. He thinks that your mind, or ontologically, he thinks you have a brain and you do not have anything like an immaterial substance called your mind. So mind is reducible to brain in some way. He, for those reasons, makes a really helpful ally, if unwilling ally, to the case that I'm making, because we can use arguments that no one is going to be able to accuse us of just sort of cherry picking or like parroting, you know, the work of Christian philosophers, for example. But independently, I mean, John Searle is a huge name in the field of the philosophy of mind. I interact in this article with an article by him. It's actually a pretty short article titled Minds, Brains, and Programs. It's reprinted everywhere. I don't think that this is the first thing he wrote in the philosophy of mind, but it's the first thing of which I became aware. And readers can just pop on Amazon and buy books by him on the philosophy of consciousness from his view, ranging in terms of degree. He's written some pretty popular, accessible works, and he has written some tremendously technical works, but he is really a force in the field of the philosophy of mind. In my view, he is this close in the philosophical sense of accepting dualism, but just never seems to be able to quite cross the Rubicon, as it were, and accept an immaterial mind, or let alone something like substance dualism.
Well, one of the things he's known for is this thought experiment called the Chinese Room. So we were just talking about the Turing test. Now we have a new phrase here, the Chinese Room. So can you explain what is the Chinese Room thought experiment?
Yeah.
I've been coming across a bunch of those in pop culture. I was just watching a series on Apple Plus TV, and they talked about, you know, Schrodinger cat in the box and all that stuff. You have to look all this stuff up. But anyway, tell us a little bit about the Chinese Room thought experiment. And So how does that relate to AI?
Yeah, that's a great question. I love a well-crafted, if odd, thought experiment. And the Turing test, as we call the imitation game, very clever, all the more so for its simplicity. And the Chinese Room, all the better. I relate so much to the Chinese Room. I've had wonderful students from China. I asked them, you know, can you write down my name, or write down something like Keith loves Julie in Chinese? And you know, they write it on a piece of paper. First of all, it's beautiful written language. But to me, it's just pretty squiggles on paper. I would have the first clue what it says. And so I think Searle must have been the same way, because he used that commonality and built a really cool thought experiment from it. So here's how it goes. So the thing about cool thought experiments is you shouldn't ask too many questions. You just have to, it's like diving into the middle of a sci-fi movie and you're like, oh, there's aliens. And you just accept that. You don't ask questions. So here goes. You imagine that a person, yourself maybe, goes to a place and you wind up being dropped into a room. And in the room, it's pretty bare bones. It's pretty bare bones. You are handed a couple of things. You're handed sort of a handful or a batch of Chinese writings, which you can't, I mean, you don't have the first clue what they say or what they mean or anything. You are outfitted with what Searle calls the rule book. And the rule book, mercifully, is written in English, and it's just syntactical rules. It just says, "Hey, when you see this squiggle symbol, this Chinese writing, then the rule is you put it with this." I left off. Searle says you put it with this squiggle symbol. You don't know what the squiggle means. You don't know what the squiggle means. You don't know what they mean together. You just follow the rules. You see a squiggle, you put it with a squiggle, and so on and so forth. The rule book tells you how to manipulate these symbols. And so then you're sort of put in this room. It's locked doors. There's nothing else in the room. And shortly, as you're sort of trying to get your bearings, another batch of Chinese writings is, sort of slid under the door. So now you've got two batches of Chinese writings, this probably pretty thick rule book. And your job is to just get to it. Start taking the batches and following the rules in the book and producing these outputs that you slide back out of the room under the door. And the thought experiment's easy to understand because I can relate to the person in the room. I mean, I'm a smart enough guy to follow rules. And I'm like, okay, look at, there's a squiggle mark shape just this way with a little thing there. And then I find it over in the other writing. I was like, okay, now that means I put a squiggle with it, send it under the door. And the beauty of this is that in the thought experiment, you, the conscious human, are put in the position of behaving exactly like AI is described as behaving. You have inputs. You have a programming that is as sophisticated as you like. In fact, the point of the Chinese room is that it stipulates maximal quality program. It's not even program. It's literally a conscious mind that the programming is trying to mimic. So it's actual conscious mind. And you generate outputs that are totally accurate. In fact, he says in the experiment, they're so accurate that somebody outside the room receiving your outputs has no idea that a person who knows not a lick of Chinese inside the room is producing them. In fact, he says, and I'll just read you this quick line from the article. Searle says, unbeknownst to the person inside the room, the people passing the writings in and out, he says, they call the first batch a script, they call the second batch a story, and they call the third batch of writings questions. He says, furthermore, they call the symbols that you give them back in response to the third batch, he says, they call them answers to the questions, and the set of rules in English they call, quote unquote, the program. And so that's the analogy. So the point of it is to show that it's perfectly coherent, perfectly believable. I think I'll go in further and say he demonstrates that. You cannot generate actual knowledge simply by following this prescribed syntactical functionality. You have inputs, you have the best programming you want, you generate outputs that an external observer can't tell are produced by a non-native Chinese speaker. Clearly, this person passes the Turing test, but what's so obvious in its simplicity is the person still doesn't know a lick of Chinese. They've passed the Turing test. Yeah, it's simple. But they don't know Chinese. And so the upshot is, given this is how AI functions, then AI, as impressive as it is, and as impressive as the results are, can be, doesn't therefore have the mental state of understanding what it's doing.
So it's interesting to use Chinese as the example, because I actually think Chinese is probably difficult to learn and understand, and I'm Asian. And just because there's so many characters, it's so different. But, you know, explain a little bit more about what the issue is in terms of the input for AI, the programming, and, you know, what you're talking about regarding understanding.
No, that's great. Yeah, so nothing about the thought experiment depends on the nature of Chinese or anything like that. It could have been, you know, Yiddish, Syriac, Coptic. I mean, to a person who doesn't have any familiarity whatever with English, it could be English. It's the lack of knowledge and the ability to lay out precise and accurate rules of syntax that matters. So yeah, the fact that Chinese is purely incidental, so we don't want anyone to get hung up on that. But it works well for me. I couldn't tell Chinese from any number of other languages, let alone what they say. So really the rub here is, and this is where, you know, it gets a little technical, but it's not too bad. When you're the person in the Chinese room, yeah, like over time, you're going to get really good at this. I mean, think of the first afternoon of, you know, flipping through page after page after page in the rule book. I mean, you don't know where to find this symbol in the book. But after over time, you will become increasingly proficient. Oh, I've seen this one before. I know it goes with this one. Oh, I've seen this one. And you probably won't even need to consult the rule book all that often after a bit. But what you're getting good at there, and I think this is an important point, is you're getting good at something that is exactly not understanding Chinese. What is it you're getting good at then? You're getting good at performing what Searle calls manipulating the symbols based purely on the rules or based purely on syntax. Think about what you're doing in the room. You're manipulating the symbols, right, of course, but it's based entirely on like the shape of the markings on the paper and the order in which they appear. You know, you see squiggle, squiggle, squaggle, squaggle, which means nothing to you except that it's two squiggles, then a squaggle, then a squaggle. And you know that when you see that, you're supposed to generate this output, right? So this is what the instructions in a rule book are all about. This and nothing else. You're not reading the outputs and thinking about their accuracy in terms of what they mean. You're just taking inputs, following your programming, generating the outputs. Well, can AI perform these kind of syntactical operations? Yeah, of course they can. And I'm happy to concede that in many, many ways, they can do it a heck of a lot better than I can. I mean, I can't, just this short article I worked for, I don't know, 2 weeks on it. But AI could have written this short, you know, was it 2,000 words article in, I don't know, a minute, say? I can barely put coherent sentences together in a minute, let alone helpful ones. But that's okay, because that's not what we're challenging. We're not challenging AI's ability to perform with tremendous speed and efficiency syntactical operations. We're trying to focus on the ability of AI to produce understanding. So I think maybe this will be helpful. When we talk to people about their ideas or something, maybe the article that we're talking about, we use the word about. Say, hey, let's talk about this sentence. But there's two different ways that you can mean about. And I should encourage your listeners here, don't tune out, stick with me, we're not going to do too much philosophy here, but we can talk about the sentence in this way. We can say, oh, I see the sentence, I do not like how long it is. I do not like this font. Oof, this sentence appears too dark. You know, the font is literally on bold and there's no need for that. That's one way of talking about the sentence. And that has nothing to do with understanding the words, the meaning conveyed by the words in the sentence. The sense in which we talk about the sentence's meaning is not about syntax. It's about the semantics, what Searle will call semantic understanding. The person in the room, the Chinese room, and this is now interchangeable, you know, with AI, is great at syntax manipulation, but is absolutely clueless when it comes to the semantics, the semantic operation. And what Searle calls a semantic operation is what we're talking about when we're talking about understanding. And that's really where the rub comes in this experiment. The problem is AI can take inputs and have programming as sophisticated as the day is long, and it can generate very persuasive, indistinguishable from human outputs, but that's not identical to semantic understanding. It's nothing but syntactical operation.
Well, I think you are breaking that down well for us, but I have some final questions for you, because part of your title of your article has the words Imago Dei in it. And that's a big kind of subject of interest to people lately about what does, you know, the worth and value of human beings mean, made in the image of God. So you tie all of these kinds of issues to the doctrine of the image of God. So does how does AI fit in there? Does that threaten what we think classically of Imago Dei?
Yeah, that's a great question. I don't think that AI poses any kind of a threat to the Imago Dei. You know, I certainly don't think that there's any sense at all in which human beings stand to lose a little bit of the image of God or anything. What moves me to even talk about this topic is, I mean, people use words figuratively all the time. Sometimes it bugs me, sometimes it doesn't. And even experts use terms sometimes in a way that's correct and maybe in their field or widely accepted, but not technically right, you know, in terms of what a philosopher would say. But it's okay. You don't have to be the language police all the time. But because I'm seeing increasingly Christians who, I of course, will believe in the image of God. I mean, Genesis 1, 26 and 27 are pretty clear. What do we read? God created humankind in his own image. In the image of God, he created them, male and female, he created them. And it's incredible. This is one of the most beautiful doctrines of the faith, I think. But when Christians, on the one hand, sort of want to believe in the image of God, and on the other hand, want to begin attributing the language of consciousness literally to AI, then I think they're just unwittingly really demeaning the image of God, because an important aspect of that image is consciousness. And that's something special about us. It's something special about our being image bearers of God's own image. And then when we become lax in using these words otherwise than figuratively to talk about things that clearly don't have the image of God, then I think it has the effect of watering down and maybe even cheapening the image of God. But that's a precious thing that I think we ought to take a little more care in how freely we attribute the language of consciousness and ultimately the image of God to non-image bearers. So this isn't to come down hard on anybody. I mean, the Lord knows I use words and labels and things that are not accurate, and I need to be corrected all the time too. But I want to encourage Christians to take this seriously. And I give just a handful of quotes there at the end of the article, just to sort of motivate the perception that this isn't just Keith Lofton's view of the image of God. The Christian tradition has always held that consciousness, and in particular understanding, is an important aspect of the image of God.
Well, you've certainly given us a lot to think about. And also, we have related articles that are older but relevant to this topic. So we will link all of those in the show notes wherever you listen to your favorite podcast, on our website and on YouTube. But finally, I have a fun question for Keith. It's August and school is about to get into full swing again. So Keith, what is one of the things or a couple of things you really enjoy about being a professor?
Oh, that's a great question. I mean, for me, the answer is first, second, third place are my students. I've got a terrific group of students studying in the PPE program here at DBU with me, and they're fun. My wife and I and our son, we love being around students. I just remember the effect that my professors had on me in college, just helping me think about what I even exist for, helping me find purpose, and just like having a good time with. I love being around the students. And I suppose another part of it too is just the life of a university, just to see other Christian scholars living their vocation of just, importantly, the life of the mind, exchanging notes with colleagues in other departments. Not so much the meetings per se, but the informal coffee meetings, just where we're getting together. I love it. I love the life of the mind and the life of a university. It's an incredible blessing to be a part of it.
Well, thanks, Keith, for being a guest again on the Postmodern Realities podcast.
That's my pleasure. Love it. Thank you.
You've been listening to episode 407 of the Postmodern Realities podcast from the Christian Research Journal. Today's guest was Dr. Keith Lofton, and he has written an online article for the Christian Research Journal. His article is called Consciousness, AI, and the Imago Dei. And you can read his article for free at our website, equip.org. You won't want to miss out on subscribing to the other podcasts from the Christian Research Institute. We have the Bible Answer Man podcast, which is published Monday through Friday with the best of the week on Saturday. It's hosted by CRI President Hank Handegraff and is available wherever you get your favorite podcasts. In addition, Hank has a podcast called Hank Unplugged. Hank takes you out of the studio and into his study to engage in free-flowing, essential Christian conversations on critical issues with some of the most interesting, informative, and inspirational people on the planet. And you won't want to miss out on the brand new podcast from the Christian Research Journal. Christian Research Journal Reads presents audio versions of Christian Research Journal articles. It was a print incarnation of almost 45 years. It's now on the web, as you know, with new articles every single week. So you won't want to miss these audio articles of some of our most popular and most accessed articles on our website, equip.org.